Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in! So this was me coming to Vermont 4th of July weekend, right?
Yes.
And I stopped at a bagel place for lunch. Never mind that I had another bagel for breakfast that day. It's nobody's business but mine.
Bagels are great. I understand yeah. It.
And I texted you saying, Emma, you're not going to believe this. 99 Luftballons is playing in this bagel joint. The German version, the original version, mind you, yes, not the English recording.
It is such a rabbit hole, because I knew a little bit of the history of the song, not all of it, but after you brought it up, I was like, it's actually quite interesting. Why is that song so wildly successful? Because in Germany, it's like one of the top songs, probably of all times. The story behind the song is so wild, because what a lot of people don't know is that she didn't write it. It was her guitarist who actually came up with the song, and their keyboard player helped arrange it, basically. But he was the one who came up with the lyrics. And it's really interesting because he was at a Rolling Stones concert sometime in the early 80s, and they were playing in West Berlin. And back then, West Berlin was like this small place completely surrounded by the Berlin Wall. Mm. And he said that like during the end of the concert, they were releasing hundreds of air balloons. And he was just like looking up and he was like, what if they go across the wall and the Soviets think that this is like a bomb or something? What if a war was started because the Rolling Stones released a hot air balloon? But then I was curious why it got so incredibly popular everywhere. And I found out that there is this book called Zoo Station, The Story of Christiane F. Now, I don't know how popular that is outside of Germany.
I have never heard of that.
Okay, because this book is so popular in Germany. Everyone has to read it in school. It's basically about, it's a biography written by this woman who at 13, I believe, ends up on the streets of Berlin. Like, it's a really, really highly acclaimed book here.
Okay.
And they made a movie about that in the early 80s. And that movie was supposed to be launched worldwide. And so she went over to the States to promote that film. And she ended up, and you're not going to believe this, on Rodney Bingenheimer's radio show.
Nothing could have prepared me for a Rodney Bingenheimer connection. Nothing at all.
He's everywhere. He needs to go on the bingo sheet because
he
everywhere.
Might have to.
And so apparently he was like asking her, what are some cool German songs? What do you like to play? And she had a copy of 99 Luftballons in her suitcase. And she's like, well, I like to listen to this, handed it over to him. And he apparently loved it so much that he started playing it 30 times a day on his radio station. And so everyone loved it. And it became this really huge hit in the US. And it ended up going up to number 2 on the charts in the German version. And then the English version didn't go so well. But it's funny because the singer, I listened to this interview with her and she was like, I'd never sang in English before. It was so awkward. I'm not good at English. And so I think she's happy that the German version was more successful. But it's such a funny story behind this song.
It is. I should have known Rodney Bingenheimer would somehow be involved in this.
When I first found out about this, I was like, I had never expected it. It does make
sense.
In
a weird way, it makes sense.
If someone could have made a German song a huge hit in the US, it must have been him. So yeah. There you have it, the random story behind that song.
The both of us have been waiting for this episode for a minute now.
We really have, because this book is like the holy grail of Vintage Girls.
I have a photo on my phone from the day that my copy of that book came in the mail.
That must have been exciting.
Oh my gosh, I was so, so excited. And now I get to present this episode, and it feels really great. So thank you for allowing me to present this.
Of course. I feel like I adore this woman, but you have like another special connection. So I felt like it was only appropriate for you to host this one, but I'm so glad. I'm just part of this today.
Thank you. Stop me if you've heard this one before. A beetle walked onto a film set, met a girl in a potato chip commercial, asked her out, and got rejected. He asked her out again. She said yes that time. The rest is rock and roll history, and you'll be hearing about it all on episode 3 of our Beetle Girl miniseries. It is an honor to present an episode about rock and roll's Helen of Troy, the woman who launched 1,000 songs, Patti Boyd. Okay, maybe she only launched around 11 songs, but still, that is a lot to be about one woman.
Yes.
This episode is based on her memoir, Wonderful Tonight, George Harrison, Eric Clapton, and Me, co-written with Penny Junor. Not everyone can relate to being the object of a rock star's affection, let alone two rock stars, but I truly believe any woman going through a divorce should read Wonderful Tonight, and anyone who is divorcing or has ever loved an alcoholic should read Wonderful Tonight. As you'll hear through today's episode, Patti's story is about a lot more than Beatlemania, photo shoots, and the rock and roll lifestyle. She broke generational cycles of trauma, gained her independence the hard way, discovered her self-worth, and finally found herself after decades of living in song.
Patricia Ann Boyd was born on March 17, 1944, in Taunton in Somerset. Her mother, Diana, was so convinced she was having a boy, she didn't think of any girls' names. When a little girl arrived, she was named for her birthday, St. Patrick's Day. Patti's birth was not the happy occasion it should have been for her parents. Diana's marriage to Patti's father, Royal Air Force Officer Jock Boyd, was pretty strained already. They were only married in the first place because Jock told Diana's family he came from money, he did not, and because he was badly injured in a plane crash. Jock's injuries meant he could never fly again. This changed his personality. Once an outgoing, dashing young pilot, Jock became reclusive and cold. Diana didn't want to marry a man like that, but she felt she had no choice. Both Patti's parents admitted down the road that they had no business ever being married. The obstacles were too steep, and at 18 and 24, they were far too young. The Boyd family moved around a lot in Patti's formative years. Her oldest brother, Colin, was born in Scotland in 1946. Shortly after they moved to Surrey in 1947, Patti's first baby sister arrived. Her name was supposed to be Helen, but little Patti couldn't say Helen yet. She could say Jenny, the name of her favorite teddy bear. So Helen Boyd became Jenny Boyd. When Patti was 4, the Boyds went to live with Diana's parents in Kenya. Jock tired of his desk job in the military, and Diana wanted to be closer to her family. There, in 1951, the fourth Boyd child arrived, a girl named Paula. While in Kenya, Patti grew close to her grandmother. She was a jolly, eccentric lady. She dyed fudge bright green and wore colored stockings before anyone else did. Patti's parents left her and her siblings to be raised by the maids and nannies of the house. The family moved around some more. Once they settled at a far less opulent home than Diana wanted, Patti was sent to boarding school. Quote, I had never felt so miserable. I didn't understand why my mother didn't want me at home with her. I felt complete and utterly bereft, unloved, unwanted, unimportant. In hindsight, Patti recognized something was going on at home. After holiday break, Patti was brought to an unfamiliar new home. Her mother was there, her siblings were there, but Jock was not. Suddenly, she was introduced to her new father. In the time Patti was at school, Diana had divorced Jock over a suspected affair, found a secretary job, and remarried to Bobby Gamer Jones. With him, she had Patti's two youngest brothers, David in 1954 and Robert, nicknamed Boo, in 1955. Like Jock, Bobby was ex-military. After the war, the Dunlop Robber Company appointed him a position in Tanzania. Diana didn't tell anyone about her relationship with Bobby, not even her own parents, until they were already married. Quote, In my childhood, nothing was ever explained. Everything was a mystery. Patty and her siblings continued to be raised by nannies and then were sent to live with Jock again for a time. Then, just 3 months into her marriage to Bobby, she returned to England with baby Paula. Patty, Colin, and Jenny were left behind in Africa. This abandonment, though temporary, traumatized Patty. She was only 9 years old and had no idea why she couldn't go with her mother. She began sleepwalking and having crying fits. After maybe 6 months, maybe a year, Patty doesn't know for sure, all of her siblings flew individually from Nairobi to join Diana and Bobby in England. Aside from birthdays and Christmases, the children seldom ever heard from Jock again. Can you imagine being abandoned
in a foreign country with, again, like staff and nannies, and all your other siblings are sent home one by one? They couldn't go home together.
This is the strangest part to me.
It boggles the mind.
Yeah. I don't understand what possibly could be the reason to not just pack all of your kids at once. It almost seems like a psycho game. And I don't think it was done intentionally. But you can only imagine, like, even how scary it must have been for a child. Patty was the oldest at 9 to go on an airplane by yourself. Mm-hmm. And that is quite the distance. They were probably in the air for like 6-8 hours. I don't know, but I can only imagine how scary that is. I once flew by myself when I was like 11 or so, and I was pretty scared, even though I knew, like, my dad brought me to the airport, my mom picked me up, and I was still scared.
And you probably went through the routines together, like, okay, this is how the airport is laid out. You're going to be here. This is what's going to happen. Then we're going to meet you here, yeah. And we're going to go here from there. None of that happened with Patty. It was just dropped off at the airport. Here's your ticket.
You go. I also wasn't abandoned for several months before that, so I had quite the trust that my parents were waiting there for me. This is always so hard for me. Whenever I hear stories like this, I keep...
Because you're a mom.
Yes.
You put yourself in your baby's shoes.
Yes, and I could never imagine doing that because for me, my child comes first. I don't want to judge the mothers because this was a very different time, and yes, I don't even know how much say her mother had in all of this, because back then, just to be realistic, it could have been that her stepfather was just like, we're going to do it like this,
and that's final.
That was the way it was done because he was the man of the house. This is what stuck with me after the Edie episode too. Mm. The idea to have a lot of staff raise your kids and then just kind of like go on living your life in a kind of selfish way.
It boggles the mind, Emma.
Yeah, we'll never know. Patty had a tough time at her new school. She had no friends there, hadn't read many books, and had never watched TV. You know that scene in Mean Girls right before Regina gets hit by the bus where she calls Katie a homeschooled jungle freak? That's what the other girls thought of Patty. Things weren't comfortable at home either. Bobby was a cruel stepfather. At the time, children were to be seen, not heard. But Patty and her siblings were punished for the slightest infractions, playing too loud, stirring pudding too fast. The children would be beaten, made to stand in the corner with their hands on their head for hours. Patty even remembers Bobby lighting the ends of her hair on fire. He had no patience for the natural shenanigans of 4 children, aged 9, 7, 6, and 2, and a baby. Jenny was the shyest of the girls. Paula was the favorite child, seldom ever punished. Patty, though, was the ringleader and often talked back. Quote, "When I arrived from Africa, I think my stepfather could see trouble ahead and decided to nip it in the bud. One night, he brought Jenny into his study and locked Patty out. He tried to use mind games to divide them, telling Jenny she was the good girl and Patty was the naughty girl. It didn't work. Since Patty, Jenny, and Colin never bonded with their parents, they trusted each other over them."
When Patty was about 13, her family suddenly moved once again because Bobby was having an affair with the neighbor's wife. Diana and Bobby didn't actually split up for a whole year after. As Patty reached her teen years and got more social, things got easier at school. At St. Martha's, she joined the Girl Guides, Girl Scouts, and would stay up late with her classmates swapping candy, reading romance novels, and listening to Cliff Richard, Elvis, Buddy Holly, and Roy Orbison. When Patty left St. Martha's in 1961, she had no plans. All she wanted to do was get out of that house. She considered becoming a flight attendant, but learning another language wasn't in the cards for her. Patty's grades were never good, and she didn't do well on her GCSEs. Diana knew someone at Elizabeth Arden. She pulled a couple strings and got Patty a job as an apprentice at the salon. Quote, "I was a general dog's body, but I must say that it was terribly glamorous because it was where I first saw fabulous magazines like Vogue, Tatler, and Harper's Bazaar." Patty didn't think of herself as pretty. She hadn't had any boyfriends in her teen years, and she didn't look like the women in these magazines. Dior's new look was still very much in the early 1960s. Patty didn't fit that petite, proportionate mold. She was tall, with long, thin, gangly arms and legs. But one day, a client who worked for Honey magazine came into the salon. She asked Patty if she'd ever thought about modeling, and put her in contact with Honey's in-house photographer. He dressed Patty in a simple striped shirt for what would be the first photos in her portfolio. They made it to Cherry Marshall, head of a modeling school. At 17 years old, Patty was one of the older girls. Finding jobs wasn't always easy. Cherry remembered, quote, "I rang Norman Parkinson, the king of them all, and asked if he'd see Patty. We knew that, superficially, Patty had certain drawbacks. She was unmodelly in the accepted sense, her face was too round, and she had a gap in her front teeth. She came back to us in tears, eyes swimming with disappointment, all set to give up. She finally blurted out, 'He asked me if it's fashionable these days to look like a rabbit!'"
That is so rude. At 17, to hear that?
Yeah, these photographers were ruthless. Still are, honestly.
Yeah.
But in 3 months, Patty had found an agency. London belonged to the young, Patty remembered. All the old class structures of our parents' generation were breaking down. All the old social mores were swept away. No one cared where you came from or what school you'd gone to, what accent you spoke with, or how much money you had. Modeling in 1960s London wasn't like modeling now. Patty would wake up every morning at 5 o'clock. She lugged around a huge bag, no wheels, full of everything she'd need. Costume jewelry, hats, wigs, and hair pieces, gloves, light and dark heeled shoes, flats and boots, and all her hair tools and makeup, plus her portfolio. Aside from the outfits provided, there were no stylists or makeup artists on set. There were no private cars to and from shoot locations. Patty had to lug everything on the train. Jobs didn't pay well. Patty lived in a cramped flat with 4 other models and didn't eat very much. She instead went to cafes for cheap cups of coffee and quick bites. "Seeing myself in magazines was so exciting," Patty remembered. "I couldn't wait to show my mother, and she was totally amazed, saying, 'How on earth did you do that?'" 6 months after her first run-in with Norman Parkinson, she posed for him for her first Vogue magazine shoot. He didn't recognize her. Quote, "I remember thinking, if I ever get the cover of Vogue, that'll be it. I will have peaked. I can give up. But you know, once you've had one..." Well, she was on the cover of Vogue 3 times through the decade. Patty came up at just the right time. London was now the fashion capital of the world and a cultural epicenter. Women had been covered up in sensible tweeds and twin sets. Suddenly, they were flaunting themselves, wearing luxurious fabrics, bright colors, huge hats, beads, big belts, buckles, and thigh-high boots. You could wear what you wanted, do what you wanted, express yourself in any way that felt right. Patty loved the excitement of modeling. It provided consistent work without being a traditional 9-to-5 job. Every day was different from the last.
There was a tremendous pressure on the girls to be thin, no matter what. Patty lived off tea and meal replacement biscuits. Then she took uppers and found a doctor who would prescribe diet pills. About her clothes from back then, Patty said, "They looked as though they were made for a child." She all but admits in her book that she had an unhealthy relationship with food. She remembers passing out on the steps of a studio after a shoot and not being fawned for hours. Patty posed for Honey, Vanity Fair, and Vogue magazines, and in fashion spreads for The Telegraph and The Times. She was known for her big blue eyes and silky blonde hair styled in a cute little flip. That hair earned her spots in commercials for shampoo.
Dop, the right shampoo for every kind of hair. Dop, Pearl Eye Shampoo by L'Oreal.
She was so essential to the fashion world at the time, she was featured on the cover of John D. Green's Birds of Britain book, with a beetle painted like a Union Jack on her nose. That photo turned out to be oddly prophetic. In November of 1963, 19-year-old Patty appeared in an ad for Smith's Crisps, potato chips for the Americans.
Just send 3 empty bags and 1 and 6 pence to Smith's Crisps for your crunch disc.
When it comes to the crunch, it's Smith's, it is!
Through that ad, Cherry scheduled Patty for what she thought was an interview for another commercial. It was all very hush-hush, but she recognized the director, Dick Lester, from a previous project. When Patty got home and answered a phone call from Cherry, she got the shock of a lifetime.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night, I should be sleeping like a log.
That interview was an audition for a role in A Hard Day's Night, and she got the part. She'd have exactly one line.
Excuse me, but these young men I'm sitting with wondered if two of us could come over and join you. I'd ask you myself, only I'm shy.
I'm sorry, miss. You mustn't fraternize with me prisoners.
Prisoners?
On her first day on set, if you can call a train car a set, she met the Beatles. Quote, they introduced themselves fleetingly. One made a crack and we all laughed and they bounced out. They were enchanting and we cursed our luck to be meeting them in school uniforms. All the guys were in character. John sarcastic and cynical, Ringo was sweet, and Paul was energetic and cute. With his dark brown beetle hair and dark brown eyes, Patty thought George Harrison was the cutest of them all. Both were so shy and nervous, they hardly spoke to each other. By the end of the day, George mustered up the courage to ask Patty out by asking if she'd marry him. She laughed, and he asked again, "Well, if you won't marry me, will you have dinner with me tonight?" At the time, Patty was going out with photographer Eric Swain. At 30 years old, he was quite a bit older than her.
Dating a 30-year-old in your early 20s is a canon event, I fear. I see the look on your
face.
We've both been there.
Oh. All Patty's friends thought Swain was creepy, and it seemed she didn't really like him either. But she was a little afraid of what he might do if she dumped him. When David Bailey joked about Patty falling in love with Paul, Swain said he'd throw himself into traffic. So Patty turned George down. About a month later, Patty worked up the courage to dump Swain. He did not, in fact, throw himself into traffic. And she miraculously crossed paths with George again via a photo call. He asked how her boyfriend was. She said she broke up with him. Brian Epstein was the chaperone on George and Patty's first date. He did most of the talking. Again, they were so nervous, they hardly spoke. It seems the second date went much better, because on Patty's 20th birthday, she brought George home to meet her family. Diana adored him, and so did Patty's little brothers.
So what was it like dating one of the most famous men in the world? Patty says, "I almost forgot that George was a famous pop star. As far as I was concerned, he was just my boyfriend." They couldn't do normal boyfriend-girlfriend things, though. Every vacation was a waiting game of not if the paparazzi would find them, but when. On their first trip with John and Cynthia Lennon, Patty and Sin had to escape the hotel disguised as maids and ride in a laundry basket in the van. If even a tissue or a clipping of hair was left behind at a hotel room, someone would find it and sell it. Patty got familiar with a whole new kind of photography. The paparazzi found her wherever she went. She was entirely ill-prepared for it all. In a 2018 Harper's Bazaar interview, she revealed, "The only thing Brian Epstein told me and the other wives and girlfriends was, don't talk to the press." She had to wear disguises to Beatles shows and leave early through a back exit. At one show, a group of girls spotted her, followed her outside, and attacked her. Terry Doran came rushing in to save her. The girls fought so viciously, one of them pulled out a clump of his hair. The Beatles circle shared an experience no one else on Earth knew, the height of Beatlemania. It was the thrill of a lifetime, but just as exhausting and dangerous.
You don't realize how much I need you. Love you all the time, I'll never leave you.
The only other women Patty could relate to were the Beatle wives and girlfriends. Patty was closest to Paul's girlfriend, Jane Asher. They both had busy working schedules. She was a famous actress. Patty found Maureen Starkey fun and relaxed. They were much closer in the 70s than in the Beatle days. And this made me a little sad to read. Patty didn't feel her friendship with Cynthia was as close as Cynthia felt it was. Quote, "We got on, but I felt there was definitely a north-south divide among the wives and girlfriends. Beatlemania drove the Beatles out of the city and into the country, where George and Patty bought their first home together. Kin Fawn's seclusion was just what they wanted. But the gate wouldn't always close right, and girls inevitably found their way to the front door. Patty and George would say hello to these girls, take a photo, and send them on their way. You can find many of these fans' Polaroids floating around on Pinterest today. At Kin Fawn's, Patty discovered her love of cooking. This was the beginning of her mending her relationship with food, which would take a very long time. When she became a vegetarian with George, she learned how to make curries. The flavors reminded her of what the staff of her grandparents' house in Africa made her. Warm and comforting."
I mean, I love the fact that they were vegetarians even back then. It was so new, such a hippie thing to do.
And it was a lot harder to be meat-free back then. There were no fancy alternatives. It was a lot of vegetables and beans.
But I think it is really impressive that they made these decisions so young. And someone like Paul McCartney, he's still a vegetarian. He's been a vegetarian for 60-something years.
George was a vegetarian for the rest of his life. Yes. He didn't allow fish or meat to be cooked in his kitchen.
I think that that is really interesting. And I love the idea that Patty probably had to learn cooking kind of all over again, because the way that you were taught to cook in the 60s or like the 50s when they grew up was very meat heavy.
Yes.
They were probably growing up on like a diet of a lot of meat and fish, especially living in England.
Pudding, shepherd's pie.
All of that, yeah. And so I feel like once you decide not to have that anymore, there's so much to learn. And I think it is so wonderful that she found her love for that and through that was able to mend a bit of her relationship with food.
One night in December, Patty and George were driving through London. He abruptly stopped the car and didn't so much propose to her as he told her, "Let's get married. I'll speak to Brian." Then he turned the car around, drove right to Brian's house, and after 15 minutes and Brian giving the okay, then he asked Patty to marry him. A few weeks later, on January 21st, 1966, Patty became Patty Harrison. Quote, "Who would have guessed the humble potato would play such an important role in my life?" It wasn't exactly the white wedding she'd dreamed of, but Brian didn't want the paparazzi crashing a big church wedding. So, like the other Beatle wives, she married George in a simple office ceremony. She wore a magenta silk shift dress, white stockings, and red shoes with a little bow in her hair. Since it was January in England and very cold that morning, Mary Quant dressed her in a red fox fur coat. It was all to match her ring, a gold band of garnets. Very hip. The matter of inviting Jock was complicated for Patty. Quote, "I didn't know how to address him. Daddy? Jock? Mr. Boyd?" She wrote the invitation to Daddy, hoping he'd come. He refused. And Paul made a scene at the reception. This is my favorite story in Beatle history, and I will take any and all opportunities to tell it. He didn't have Jane around to supervise him, so he got very drunk, wrangled David and Boo for a little adventure outside. David somehow procured a bow and arrows and shot an arrow right through the windshield of Paul's brand new Rolls Royce.
This is so funny. I think this story is so great because it sums this whole situation up so well. Because I think what I particularly love about this story is when you read about the Beatles at this point, you're like, okay, they're super famous. They're all starting to get married. But you kind of forget how young they were. And this story just reminds you that they were just like a couple of kids.
Patty and George were 22 and 21 when they got married.
That is so young.
Paul, being the ringleader of Patty's little brothers and facilitating the wrecking of his brand new car via arrow, is the most 22-year-old man thing I've ever heard. Like, this wouldn't be out of place in my college friend group. There was an incident with a flamethrower. We really weren't that far off.
Yeah.
I am not married, so I don't know this, but from my family weddings, there's always this, at every wedding, someone is a little overserved, and then there's this funny story that gets told over and over and over again for decades.
Yeah. I can just say that a couple of weeks ago, my husband and I went to a wedding, and we don't go out much anymore because we have a kid, you know, but it was really fun. It was my best friend's wedding, and my husband got pretty drunk, which I'm okay with because he generally doesn't ever drink because we don't go anywhere. It wasn't that much, yeah, but he's also a very, like, open person, and so as we were leaving, he just started kissing everyone goodbye on the cheek. He just, like, went around and he, like,
hugs and kisses
my kindergarten friend's parents. It was so funny. But everyone, it was like a very sweet and funny
moment.
Yes. And everyone, we're all still, I mean, of course we're still talking about it. It hasn't been that long, but I think this is, like, one of the stories that even my best friend, she'll probably tell her kids, like, when I got married, someone was kissing everyone. So, it's such a lovely story, and I really like how, as that, this makes them feel like real persons during a time when they were so highly portrayed by the media. Though the Beatles stopped touring in 1966, their lives kept moving at breakneck speed. It was fast and maybe a little weird now that LSD was in the mix. George, Patty, John, and Cynthia all tried it for the first time together. Their dentist dosed them all at a dinner party. This is such a wild story. They tried to go to a club while tripping. That proved to be a terrible idea. Quote, people kept recognizing George and coming up to him. They were moving in and out of focus, then looked like animals. We clung to each other, feeling surreal. And thanks to Patty, the Beatles' worlds expanded spiritually too. In February of 1967, Patty saw an ad in the Sunday paper for Transcendental Meditation classes in London. Transcendental meditation is the Maharishi's path to a more centered life and eventually spiritual enlightenment. Followers were assigned a mantra, which they would repeat to themselves in meditation for anywhere from 20 minutes to a few hours. Patty liked the idea. She felt it would give her life some direction. After discovering the sitar on the set of Help, George was all about all things India. He got the rest of the Beatles hip to the idea of transcendental meditation. All the Beatles, minus Ringo, met at the Maharishi in London. Ringo came along to the 10-day TM retreat in Bangor. Brian Epstein didn't. It was a bank holiday weekend, so he joined everyone else in a couple of days. He did not. 2 days into the retreat, Brian suddenly passed away. The Beatles were set adrift. They turned to transcendental meditation and the Maharishi as they grieved. He invited them all to his ashram in Rishikesh the next spring. In the meantime, the Beatles recorded Sgt. Pepper's and opened their ill-fated Apple boutique. All the Beatles had extreme irregular relationships with substances. In August of 1967, George and Patty traveled to San Francisco. It appears at least part of the trip was much colder than they thought. Patty's wrapped up in a shawl and wearing tights that don't match that iconic fool dress. There, George wrote Blue Jay Way about a friend running late and fell out of love with LSD. They were expecting Haight-Ashbury to be a magical place. Instead, they discovered STP had replaced LSD. Patty and George were followed to and from Hippie Hill, and the crowd became vaguely hostile. Or maybe everyone was just really high and the vibes were off. Either way, quote, that was a turning point for George. We had always thought of drugs as fun, a means of expanding your mind and consciousness. What we saw at Haight-Ashbury was an eye-opener. There was nothing remotely artistic or creative about those people. They were like alcoholics or any other kind of addict, and it turned George right off from the whole drug culture. While George chose meditation over drugs, Patty found herself pressured to choose between being a working model and George's wife. She had to get up very early in the mornings and didn't come back until night. He didn't like the attention modeling gave her from the men on set and from the prying eyes of Beatles fans. In February of 1968, Patty, George, Paul and Jane, John and Cynthia, and Ringo and Maureen, plus Mia, Johnny and Prudence Farrow, Donovan, his best friend Gypsy Dave, Beach Boy Mike Love, and Magic Alex touched down in Delhi. From there, they drove 6 hours to the Maharishi's ashram in Rishikesh. It was beautiful there, tucked away where the Himalayas meet the plains and the river flows out the mountains. It was greener than Ireland, and they stayed in little stone chalets right out of a fairy tale. Every morning they awoke to peacocks calling, had communal meals, attended lectures by the Maharishi, and broke off to meditate alone. The sunsets were bright pink. Patty found the Maharishi's lectures fascinating. She enjoyed meditating. Gradually, the Maharishi allowed the group to meditate as long as they liked. The longest Patty meditated was for 7 hours, and she described having an out-of-body experience on other occasions. There's an interesting divide between when people arrived at the ashram and how seriously they took the whole thing. Paul and Ringo were on the second flight. Ringo bailed after 2 weeks, and Paul described Rishikesh as more of like a vacation than a retreat later on. He was eager to get back to Apple Corps. George and John were on the first flight. They took it very seriously.
But there was a snake in the grass at Rishikesh. No one knows exactly why the remaining Beatles left the ashram in such a hurry. Whatever happened, it left a bad taste in the Beatles' mouths, and according to Cynthia and Patty's memoirs, Magic Alex was somehow involved. He told John and George that the Maharishi, quote, had tried something with a girl he had befriended. John took this as his excuse to be with Yoko Ono. George, Patty, and Jenny were the last to leave. They took a detour south to see Ravi Shankar before returning to England. George didn't want to go right back to the chaos of the Beatle world.
So I heard several rumors about what might have happened there. The one story that I see being told a lot is that Magic Alex kind of like witnessed the Maharishi making moves on Mia Farrow, and she was very uncomfortable about it.
Yes, that's in the anthology.
Yes, and it's also like it comes up every now and then as like the most plausible story of what most likely happened.
Yes.
There's no certainty behind it, but I do think that this is most likely what happened. Like, it would make a lot of sense from what everyone has told. And if so, I think it is good that they all stood up for her in a sense, that they were like, okay, this crossed the line. We're leaving here. We will never know. I just wanted to add that here in case anyone else has come by this story.
At George's house, the Beatles demoed some 30-something songs for what would become the White Album. Patty can be heard on one of those songs. She sings with Yoko and Maureen on Birthday. This wasn't the first time she was invited into the studio. She sings a little bit in the background on Yellow Submarine with Marianne Faithfull and I think Brian Jones.
I think so too.
Was he there?
Yes.
So Yoko wasn't the first woman in the studio. It was Patty.
Yeah. In like the earlier Beatles days, Jane Asher was there a lot too. She didn't go into the studio, but she was there when they would come over to her parents' house to write their songs. So the whole thing of Yoko being like the first woman to ever set a foot into the Beatles' sacred space of making music.
And that was some kind of problem.
It's wild.
We'll get into that in a future episode. Yoko was there a lot. We're going to put a pin in this for later. Another song wasn't quite done for the White Album, but during that period, George wrote his most successful song. He had written songs about Patty before, I Need You, Off Help, and It's All Too Much, which ended up on the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. Something was something else entirely.
Something in the way moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave now. You know I believe in how. Thank you.
That's the thing about George's songs. From the demo, you know it's going to be special. Something made it onto Abbey Road, and a double A-side single with Come Together. It peaked at number one in the US and was covered by the likes of Joe Cocker, Elvis Presley, and Frank Sinatra. James Brown's version was George's favorite. Patty's favorite? The one by George Harrison, which he played to me in the kitchen in Kinfons. Like White Album sessions were the end of the simple, uncomplicated, collaborative heaven the Beatles had enjoyed thus far, post-India was the beginning of the end for George and Patty. George had fundamentally changed. India, quote, answered some of the nagging questions he had about his life, but it had taken some of the lightness out of his soul. He retreated into himself instead of confiding in her like he did before. The drug bust at Kinfons was a PR nightmare. Patty swears Sergeant Pilcher set them up and was very stressful on the marriage. It made it a lot harder for Patty to see Jenny, too, after she moved to LA with Mick Fleetwood. Through all of this, Diana was badgering Patty over the matter of children. Why didn't she have any grandkids yet? The truth was, Patty and George so desperately wanted children, but were struggling to conceive. This is very stressful on marriage, too. And there was another woman. Lots of other women, actually. He was a serial cheater. Do you remember in Get Back when George leaves the band? Part of that frustration bubbling over was some trouble on the home front. George was in the doghouse. Patty had just caught him cheating on her with, quote, a young French girl she was friends with, and who came to stay with the Harrisons after her boyfriend broke up with her. Quote, if I accused him of anything, he would deny it. He made me feel I was being unreasonable, nasty, and suspicious. Textbook gaslighting. Things got worse through the fall. The Beatles' messy unraveling over Alan Klein had begun, and George's mother fell ill. He took to meditating for hours alone to cope, confiding in Patty even less. Her modeling career was waning. Though she had hobbies, she knitted, she loved cooking, she learned how to fly a plane.
That's so
And she
cool.
even owned a boutique with Jenny. Yes, very cool that she could fly. And she even owned a boutique with Jenny. She was lonely. Enter Eric Clapton.
Eric and Patty first crossed paths at Cream's gig at the Seville. That'd be July 2nd, 1967, because of course Abby can put a date on that. As George closed his raga rock era with the Wonderwall soundtrack, drifted away from the Beatles, he got closer to Eric. He wrote Here Comes the Sun in the garden at Eric's estate, Hurtwood Edge. And remember that French girl George cheated on Patty with? According to author Peter Dodgett, that girl was allegedly Charlotte Martin, Eric Clapton's girlfriend. The hints in Patty's book corroborate this. Obviously, Eric would have known something was wrong in his best friend's marriage. He would seek Patty out. He paid special attention in conversation, asking questions, and really listening to her answers. He complimented her outfits and her cooking, and went out of his way to make her laugh. Quote, those were all things George no longer did. But Patty saw this as no more than harmless flirting. The Harrisons' marriage was put under even more stress by their move to Friar Park. The whole house had to be renovated, and George invited a bunch of Hare Krishnas to move in with them. You can see one in Get Back. One morning, Patty received a mysterious letter. It was addressed to Patty Harrison, but the sender wrote, Dearest L. There was no return address. It was the most passionate letter Patty had ever seen. She showed it to George. They laughed it off. Eric called later that night. He asked Patty, did you get my letter? It was the most passionate letter anyone had ever written to me. And it put our relationship on a different footing. It made the flirtation all the more exciting and dangerous. While holed up in Hurtwood Edge with what would become Derek and the Dominoes, Eric wrote endlessly about Patty, or Elle, as he'd taken to calling her. An interloper had given Eric and Patty both copies of The Story of Layla and Majnun, the ancient Persian tale of the madman's poet's forbidden love with the princess Layla. Eric saw himself as Majnun and Patty Layla. It and his obvious obsession for Patty provided Eric endless inspiration, a whole double album's worth. Upon returning from Miami with a pair of jeans for Patty, the bell-bottom blues, Eric invited her to his crash pad in South Kensington. There he played her the title track of his new album. It was Layla, his ultimate confession of love to her. Quote, he played it to me two or three times, each time watching my face intently for my reaction. My first thought was, oh God, everyone's going to know who this is. I felt uncomfortable that he was pushing me in a direction I wasn't certain I wanted to go. But the song got the better of me with the realization that I had inspired such passion and such creativity, I could resist no longer. Eric remembers that night slightly differently, quote, we just kind of collided to the point where there was no turning back. Later that night, Patty went to see O Calcutta with Peter Brown. After intermission, Patty found Eric in the seat next to her. Then she went to a party with Peter, and Eric was there too. Naturally, they linked up, but who would show up but George? He found them chatting in the garden in the early morning hours. He demanded to know what was going on. To Patty's horror, Eric clapped and responded, I have to tell you, man, I'm in love with your wife. George made Patty choose on the spot. Either she was staying with Eric or coming home with George. She picked George. All Things Must Pass and Layla and other assorted love songs came out that November. While All Things Must Pass was both the first number one single and number one album by a Beatle after their breakup, Layla flopped. Though the guitar duel is a myth, George and Eric's friendship now had a wedge in it. George's mother passed away that spring, and he meditated even more to grieve. Eric's ego was bruised. Trying to force Patty's hand, he turned up at Friar Park with a baggie of heroin, threatening to take it if she didn't run off with him. Of course, Patty freaked out and refused. Though Eric was exciting, she loved George. She was married to George. He made one last appeal to her in the most passionate letter yet. She wrote back but sent another letter negating it. I love you, even though you're chicken, he replied. Aside from the concert for Bangladesh, they didn't see each other for years. The worst part of the Layla fallout? Eric was dating Patty's teenage sister Paula at the time. He was only seeing her to fill the void of Patty. When Paula heard Layla, she knew it was about her sister and not her. She was devastated. Her relationship with Patty was never the same after. This is so heartbreaking. Can you imagine being in love with someone who writes a love song and you're probably think this must be about me? And like a couple minutes in, you start to realize, because there must have been a moment where she was like, this is not about me.
This can't be about me.
Yeah.
If I had to guess, it probably would have been the line, tried to give you consolation when your old man let you down, directly referencing George cheating on Patty with allegedly Charlotte. And the fact that Paula is a teenager, roped into all of this, Eric used Patty's teenage sister as a replacement for her.
It's sickening, yeah.
Yeah, the longer this story goes on, the harder it gets to like or empathize with Eric Clapton.
I need to recharge my laptop, so I'm gonna get the cable.
Good. Good. We don't need any dying laptops in here.
Yes. See you in a minute.
This is a real professional operation, people. I'm gonna take this break to have a little snack because I low-key started eating a scone.
Okay, I'm back. Recording's working again. Right microphone.
See, I believe that your favorite Beatle reveals a lot about who you are as a person, both the positive and the negative traits. Like, of course George is my favorite Beatle. I'm the most food-driven person you know. This should also be on the bingo card, Abby eats on a call. I forget what episode this was, but like, I seriously said, can we hold off for 10 minutes? I gotta finish my donut.
It's all good.
Patty and Eric's paths crossed again at his comeback show at the Rainbow in 1973. He had kicked the heroin, but used alcohol and cocaine to do it. By this time, the Harrisons' marriage was in shambles. There were even more women.
Communication had completely broken down. Their only go-betweens were Terry Doran and Patty's best friend, Chris O'Dell. George thwarted a vacation with Patty and Paula to Portugal to go to Spain with Ronnie Wood. There, George cheated on Patty with Chrissy Wood, who she was also friends with. The accounts of Ronnie and Patty together have been vastly overblown over the years. They had, like, a little thing, but it wasn't anything serious like Eric and Patty proved to be. George also made a move on Chris, but she said no. The final straw, though, was cheating on her with Maureen Starkey, Ringo's wife. Quote, "She was the last person I would have expected to stab me in the back, but she did." George confessed to being in love with Maureen at her and Ringo's house. There's some serious dramatic irony to what went down with Eric 5 years before.
I wonder whether that is where he got the inspiration. Whether he was like, well, this happened to me once before, so I'm just gonna go bluntly in with the I'm in love with your wife thing.
Well, didn't work for Eric that time.
It didn't work for anyone George? Ever. This has been done 2 times, and both times it was not successful.
If I had a nickel for every time I heard the line, "Listen, man, I'm in love with your wife," in this episode, I'd have 2 nickels. Which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice, right?
Like, I was saying this as you were saying it in my head. This is so engraved into my head. It's weird that it happened twice.
On July 1st, 1974... Patty left George, taking no more than her car and her clothes with her. She flew to America to be with Jenny. It felt like free fall. She was no longer with the man she loved for 10 years, who was there waiting to catch her, but Eric Clapton. Amazingly, George and Eric remained friends. Insert the famous husbands-in-law quip here. That summer, Eric asked Patty to join him on tour. She instantly loved the loud music, the crowds cheering, and watching Eric do the thing he loved from backstage. Seeing all the lighters in the crowd through the slow song sent a chill up her spine. It's not hard to fall in love with that thrill.
Mm-mm.
Patty had never been allowed to tour with the Beatles, and George didn't tour until after they broke up, and then he never toured again.
Yeah.
So she'd just never had this experience before. The tour was grueling, 26 cities in a matter of weeks. Eric drank the whole way through. He'd start in the morning and go all day until his manager Roger swapped his cognac with tea. Eric was so drunk he wouldn't know the difference. By the time the show started, he'd be sober enough to play. This is how he functioned, day in and day out, same with his band. Touring was a very male world. Life revolved around food, alcohol, women, and playing outrageous pranks on each other. Patty began drinking and using cocaine to keep up with them. She felt useless on this tour, like she didn't deserve to have the fun the musicians did. Life with Eric was like a zoo. Really, he loved animals. Dogs, cats, even a racehorse. Hurtwood Edge was a revolving door. He always had to have his friends, his playmates around. He was a sucker for a theme, having Patty make him pasta when he watched The Godfather, or putting on his equestrian gear when the horse races were on.
I love that.
He was a big kid at heart, in good ways and the bad. He nicknamed Patty Nell, perhaps after his favorite aunt? Okay. But when they were alone, things were uneasy. Eric saved all his emotion for the stage. All the passion in his letters and songs had evaporated. Things were easier when they were out. Patty could see friends, and Eric had an excuse to drink. Diana didn't like him when he dated Paula, and she liked him even less this time around. She probably thought, "Stay the hell away from my family, please.
Yeah.
What is your obsession with my daughters?" She saw him as low class. Chris O'Dell didn't like him either. She refused to be near him at the wedding. Still, Patty persevered with the relationship. Eric ran hot and cold. But when he was in the mood to be in love with her, it was passion unlike anything she had ever felt. If she asked for a light, he'd have lit the whole world on fire for her. One night, she couldn't decide what to wear to one of her friends' parties. Eric was getting impatient, doing all this waiting around, and took up one of his many guitars to keep the time. When Patty finally came down the stairs, asking Eric if she looked all right, he felt a rush of inspiration. That burst of love he felt for his girlfriend, a simple, uncomplicated moment of love, inspired his greatest hit. quote, "Wonderful Tonight was the most poignant reminder of all that was good in our relationship," Patty remembers. "And when things went wrong, it was torture to hear it."
The schedule-less life of a musician was rife for Eric's alcoholism to worsen. There was no set pattern to life. He'd wake up all hours for a drink. He was drinking 2 bottles of brandy a day, plus whatever he'd had at the pub with his friends. Patty tried to tell him to stop. He was drinking too much, but it never went well. Alcoholism and addiction being so normalized in the music industry made Eric feel he didn't have a problem. No one spoke out about being an alcoholic back then. Eric would be one of the first musicians to do it some decades later. Patty was completely naive to this side of Eric's life when she began seeing him. She envisioned him to be the fearless romantic, the knight in shining armor riding in to sweep her off her feet. The realities of their relationship were a lot more complicated. About a year and a half in, Eric realized he had nothing in common with Patty. Like George, he came from the working class. Patty did not. She grew up in colonial Africa and London. He didn't really have manners. Getting up in the middle of a meal to go play guitar, going to bed before sending guests off. In hindsight, he realized his pursuit of Patty was entirely selfish and purely aspirational. He didn't want Patty. He wanted what George had. Once he had her, she was disposable. He too began cheating on her with her friends. Quote, "I started to say something to my friend Jenny, who'd she left alone with Eric while she went to lunch with her sister. Eric cut her off. He lashed out at her saying, 'I'm in love with this girl. Go away and leave us alone. Just fuck off.' Feeling very hurt by this, Patty went to stay with some friends in LA. After a few weeks, she got a shocking phone call. Eric wanted to marry her. If she didn't accept, they were through. She called him back and only accepted his proposal on the condition he was through with her friend Jenny. Patty Boyd became Patty Clapton the next Tuesday, March 27th, 1979, while Eric was on tour in Tucson, Arizona. It was the closest to a white wedding Patty ever had. She found a cream silk dress at a vintage store, and her bridesmaids were blue. Eric wore a cowboy hat. Again, he was always one for a theme, and started a cake fight at the hotel reception. They held another party at Hurtwood Edge for the rest of their friends who couldn't make it to Tucson. Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall got together there. George went, so did Paul and Ringo. They all got up on stage and played together. It was the closest they'd ever get to a Beatles reunion. What Patty didn't know was that this wedding only came about through one of Eric's drunken games of pool. He bet his manager £10,000 that he could get his name in the papers the next morning. Roger's response? He went right to the Daily Mail and told them Eric Clapton was to marry his girlfriend, Patty Boyd, ex-wife of Beatle George Harrison, the next Tuesday. Patty's world revolved around Eric's drinking. Soon, she no longer recognized herself. After a stint at a hospital following an ulcer, he was right back to drinking 2 bottles a day and more. When he was sober, he expressed suicidal ideation, worrying her even more. After disappearing for hours on Christmas morning, Patty found him in the basement, slumped over the firewood. He checked into rehab for the first time. While her husband was in treatment in America, Patty began attending Al-Anon meetings. For the first time, she found herself in a group of people who were also married to alcoholics. It was the first time in a very long time she felt she could relate to people. And the first time ever she felt someone related to her pain. She recounts a role-play exercise their group was instructed to do one meeting. Quote, "We had to make ourselves into a human sculpture with the alcoholic on his hands and knees in the middle. Everyone else leaned against him, symbolizing all the people in his life who looked after him. Wife, children, mother, father, brothers, sisters, and so on. When the alcoholic gets better, he is removed from the sculpture and everyone else collapses. All the ills in the family with an alcoholic member are blamed on him and his affliction until, subconsciously, their whole way of life evolves around him." This bled into her relationship with her sister Paula, who was also an alcoholic.
When Eric got out of treatment, he was angry. He could no longer do the one thing he enjoyed in life, which was drinking. He took it out on those closest to him. In her book, Patty attempts to reconcile Eric's treatment of her. She thinks that anger toward his mother informed his relationships with all the women in his life. He couldn't punish his mother for abandoning him, so he punished the women around him simply for being there. This included Patty. He belittled her when she didn't pack his suitcases exactly right. If she couldn't find the exact shirt he wanted to wear, he'd launch into a tirade. If she wanted to knit at home instead of go drinking with him, he'd flip out. He screamed at her in hotel lobbies and elevators, made rude jokes at dinner with her friends, cheated on her. And this is the most upsetting. Quote, I'd pray he would pass out when he came to bed and not try to touch me. There were times when he was more like an animal than the loving, passionate husband I'd known and reeked of brandy. In interview in 1999, Eric admitted to sexually assaulting her. Quote, there were times when I just took sex with my wife by force and thought that was my entitlement. I had absolutely no concern for other people at all. Patty only corroborated this. Here she was, accepting this horrible treatment from Eric because it was all she knew. She grew up with a damaged, distant, and cold father, then a cruel, bully stepfather who cheated on her mother. Her mother tolerated it because that's what she was raised to do. It's what Patty was raised to do as well. She should cook, clean, look pretty, and never challenge the man. She mothered both men in her life, George and Eric, the, quote, little boys in long trousers. From the outside, it's horribly misogynistic. It took decades for Patty to unlearn this way of thinking. Quote, I played the part of the little woman. She went through several painful rounds of IVF treatment, while Eric refused to cut back on his drinking and drug use, both of which affect sperm count. At 36 years old, her doctor told her she was too old to safely carry her own children. She then considered adoption. According to British law, she could only adopt from, quote, a third world country. But Patty decided against this too. She was scared Eric would go on a racist rant in front of their child. So, Clapton's autobiography is a good read.
Yeah.
It gives a lot of insight. He really unpacks why he is an addict. And Life in 12 Bars is a good watch. But the one thing that really gets me is, in both Clapton, the autobiography, and Life in 12 Bars, that racist rant that he went on stage is just sort of explained away, like, oh, I was a drunk back then, but I'm better now. Drinking doesn't make you do crazy things. It makes you do and say things you were thinking of before, but had, I guess, the social graces not to do.
I mean, in hindsight, Eric Clapton has had this very long history of saying things that aren't okay, and he's still doing it. So it isn't even like at some point he changed and...
Which is what he tries to play it off as.
Yes, but I think I'm a fan of Eric Clapton. I adore his music, but I think he has proven over and over again that he isn't a good person.
And his treatment of Patty... Hello.
Yeah. I think people try to kind of like brush this off because the way that people react to someone having beat addiction and you kind of like forgive them for absolutely everything that happened because it is so great that they made it out. And it really is great. And I think it's such an accomplishment to be a drug addict and make it out in any sort of way.
And to be Eric doing all of that so publicly. That I commend him for.
Absolutely. He has all of my respect for that. But still, it's kind of what Ringo said. Ringo said, I was an asshole and I also drank. And Eric Clapton is saying,
I was an asshole because I drank.
Yes.
Being the Eric Clapton super fan in the room, I have a very complicated relationship with the guy and his art. But I found a really great metaphor the other night.
Mm-hmm.
It's like having an estranged father, which I also have a lot of experience with. You admire him for what he gave you and you honestly wish for the best, but then you log on to Facebook and you're like, oh God, what's he on now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, stop ruining your legacy, man.
Yes, because you're making it worse whenever you open your mouth.
Patty reached a breaking point and actually left Eric for a time. She was seeing someone else who encouraged her to go to therapy. In the foreword of her book, Patty says that writing Wonderful Tonight was a therapy exercise for her to work through everything that had happened in very publicly. but how she as a person felt, not Patty Harrison or Patty Clapton.
Yeah.
Eric saw therapy as a threat. If she saw everything wrong in their relationship, he could no longer control her. So he did everything in his power to undermine the therapist's efforts. Eric coaxed Patty back with a series of letters, some romantic, some vaguely threatening. As his last real effort to save his marriage, Eric wrote another song for her, Pretty Girl, off the album Money and Cigarettes.
Pretty girl, you are the light of my life. I mean my everything. You are the one I chose to make my wife. That's why you wear my ring. And when I'm feeling down and out, you are the one who will bail me out. My love will always guide me home. Pretty girl, my pretty girl.
So the ban on wives and girlfriends on tour was lifted. She wouldn't go on tour with him again in October of 1985. Then, she suspects, is when Eric met Lori Del Santo. That Christmas, Eric told Patty unthinkable, earth-shattering news. He was having a child with Lori. Where George cheating on her with Maureen Starkey felt like being stabbed in the back, finding out Eric had fathered not one, but two other children with other women, as it turns out, when Patty had been trying to have a child for 21 years, felt like getting stabbed in the heart. It was too much for her to bear. She went to visit her friends Mike and Angie. There, for the first time ever, she cried over what had happened. She cried uncontrollably for days. I was having a breakdown. I was grieving. Not just over the loss of my marriage to Eric, but finally, after all these years, the loss of my marriage to George. Bill Wyman was hiding out at that house, too. The public found out he was dating a 14-year-old. Seeing the media firestorm around him made Patty feel better. Well, at least I'm not that guy. It could always be worse, she thought. She tried one last time to reconcile with Eric. Patty naively thought she could co-parent his son with him and Lori. After one final verbal assault on the morning of her 43rd birthday, Patty left for good. Quote, however much I might have thought I loved Patty at the time, the truth is that the only thing I couldn't live without was alcohol, Eric confessed.
Because she didn't have children, Patty got next to nothing from either of her separations. It was very difficult for a single woman to divorce wealthy, powerful men back then. She had a lot of trouble finding a lawyer to represent her. She didn't get much more than her car from the divorce with George. Eric gave her a Cartier watch and enough money to buy her first apartment. But his lawyers creatively cut her out of the royalties of Eric's most successful songs about her. It was humiliating for Patty to have to ask for financial help from either of her exes. She felt like a failure. Eric helped her buy her first house. It was the least he could do after all he put her through. Losing her was the wake-up call Eric needed to get sober. In a truly deranged and somehow clear-headed move, he gave the Layla painting to George as a replacement for the real Patty. George then gave it to Patty. Meanwhile, Patty was left to put her life back together. She had to learn independence the hard way. She didn't know she had to pay a light bill or water bill while living in her apartment. She lost her driver's license and was unfamiliar with the tube after so many years of having drivers. She was unemployable after so many years of not having a job. As Eric revived his career, Patty saw his face everywhere. She'd burst into tears at the slightest thing. Quote, once upon a time, I had been so brave, so fearless. I was the girlfriend from Africa, who was game for anything. But now I was afraid of everything. She'd been an alcoholic's caretaker for so long, she forgot who she was. It was her friend Amanda Lear who reminded her of who she was. When Patty called her saying, "I used to be Patty Boyd," Amanda said, "You still are." Patty reconnected with old friends like Mary B. and Ringo and his new wife Barbara. Jill Wetton, John Wetton of King Crimson's wife, was there for Patty too. She was married to an alcoholic as well, so they could relate over having to live lives in secrecy. After decades of trying to find a hobby she loved, Patty discovered her love of photography. It went back to her earliest days as a model. She'd asked the photographers on set about lighting and the cameras they used. She became a photographer herself. She had her first exhibition of her work called Shared Memories in 2005 and has been regularly showing her work ever since. She even got back into modeling to rebuild her confidence as she aged. She even found love again with her current husband, Rod Weston. He is not a musician, thank God. Patty describes him as, quote, loving, supportive, and encouraging. I felt as though I was slowly crawling out of the dark hole where I had been for a very long time. And although it took time for my eyes to adjust to the light, it was wonderful to feel the warming rays of the sun on my back. Patty and Rod, Mr. Patty Boyd, have been married for 10 years.
I'm sure Rod would love being called Mr. Patty Boyd.
He seems so sweet. I love the pictures of them together.
They actually broke up for a little while. They were broken up when Patty wrote Wonderful Tonight.
Ooh, that's interesting.
She was like, I am not being treated well. I'm going to put my foot down. And she broke up with him until he changed. Only then did she take him back, and then they got married. That is such character development for her.
Yes.
The Patty of 50 years ago would have just put up with anything.
Yeah.
Because she didn't have the confidence to stand up for herself.
Absolutely. But then also, Rod seems like a different kind of person. Yes,
yes. And she found a man willing to change for her. In recent years, it seems the public opinion on Patty has turned. She, of course, has faced the misogyny every rock and roll ex-wife has faced, even more so having left George for Eric. Her Christie's auction 2 years ago garnered a lot of backlash. It was quite successful. The Layla painting alone sold for $2.56 million. People felt Patty was profiting off her relationships with famous men. The way I see it is, Patty is in her 80s. She has no children. Who would have to fight over all that stuff? Her sisters and brothers' kids? That's not fair to them. Better someone who values these objects has them. Whoever has that fool dress, value it for me.
I also think it is perfectly fine for her to capitalize on this because these men have capitalized on her all their careers.
For decades!
Yes, and so
Eric still plays Layla in Wonderful Tonight
yes.
Live.
So why shouldn't she sell that painting? I think it is her got them right to sell whatever they ever gave her.
It's another step in her healing process. She's letting all of that stuff go.
Yeah.
It no longer defines her anymore. Patty faced another minor controversy when she announced she'd be selling some of her photographs as NFTs. I, for one, am so glad the NFT craze has blown over.
Yes, that was such a fever dream.
Just take a screenshot, man. Oddly enough, Patty doesn't give much weight to being the muse of two such talented men. Quote, although something about me might have made them put pen to paper, it was really all about them. You can't deny there's something about her, though. As of us recording this episode, the three most famous songs about Patty, Something, Layla, and Wonderful Tonight, have a cumulative 1,517,857,769 streams on Spotify. That's after me factoring in the extra listens to Layla I will surely incur while editing this episode together.
I was just gonna say, only half of these are probably from the two of us. So there are some other people who really enjoy the music.
What is it about Patty that's captured the hearts of so many people and two rock and roll stars? In his memoir, Eric said he found her, quote, unusually beautiful. This impression was strengthened by spending time with her. I remember thinking that her beauty was also internal. It wasn't just the way she looked, although she was definitely the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. It was deeper. It came from within her, too. It was just the way she was, and that captivated me. You heard it here, folks. Patty is beautiful inside and out. What Marianne Faithfull means to Emma, Patty means to me. She was my aha moment in fashion. The songs about her were my first aha moment in music. It was just my aha moment in life. I named my old blog after her, Real Life Layla. My profile picture on everything is me edited into the Layla art. I think I'll be referencing media related to her and her style for the rest of my life. And her story of loving an addict hit really close to home for me. It opened my eyes to a lot of things about love and addiction. Patty is still an icon in her 80s. 2 years ago, Vogue Online ran a Get the Look article about her 1966 wedding to George, and she appeared in a Harper's Bazaar photo spread with Taylor Swift in 2018. In 2022, she published a photo book of her shoots and her own photography called My Life in Pictures. She was friends with George until his passing in 2002, and remains civil with Eric. She's a better woman than me. Though she went through a lot of pain and shed many tears, Patty has no regrets. Quote, I have had the most extraordinary life, and ultimately the most rewarding and enriching life, and I wouldn't change a day of it. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of the one and only Patty Boyd.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until the next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.